Hello and welcome to Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons. For this edition, I muck out with Kenny, the salt of the earth loo cleaner who's become an Australian box office sensation. Actor Ian Glen goes behind the Iron Curtain with Catherine Tate, and I talk stammers and spelling bees with Spellbound director Jeffrey Blitz. No fewer than 17 films are officially released at your cinemas this week, and by anyone's book, that's surely too many. I'll endeavour to be some kind of rough guide, but first, let's get dirty with Kenny. The creation of comedian and actor Shane Jacobson, Kenny has captured Australian hearts. With his belly, overalls and sleeves-up approach to life, Kenny's somehow become the nation's biggest folk hero since Crocodile Dundee. Kenny works tirelessly for splashdown toilets, building and cleaning those mass loos you see at rock festivals and outdoor events. Captured in a very funny and even touching mockumentary by his brother Clayton as director, Shane Jacobson's Kenny, flush with success down under, surfaces here this week. I went to meet the man who's proud to be number one with your number twos.
Well, that's a very humbling experience. I've come into to a room, just for anyone who's listening who doesn't know what happened, I've walked into a room ready to do an interview and seen an entire lobby of people all hanging around you. You're the bigger star than me, there's no doubt about it.
Well, you know, I've been practising this. I've courted fame, I've chased fame. You've had fame thrust upon you, Kenny.
Yeah, just I went out to collect the mail and there it was sitting in the driveway, as they say. It's a bit of a weird thing, but I mean, by the same token, I don't want to use the word fame. I think that should be saved for somebody who is famous, you know, like, I don't know, you know, John Travolta or something, or Robert De Niro, you know. I don't think it should be, you know, Kenny the Plumber. I think it'd make more sense if Jack the Ripper was more famous than Kenny the Plumber, wouldn't you think?
Yeah, well, I mean, in a way that you and Jack the Ripper are very similar, because you both kind of deal in the gutter.
Well, I mean, you know, I mean, there's a big difference. He used to murder people, and I mop up after people. There's a big difference, I would think. You know, and he used to leave a trail of blood and the stuff that I'd mop up, trails of other people's leftovers. But I'd like to think I'm not being compared necessarily to Jack the Ripper. I'd like if someone said, "G'day, Kenny, you're a little ripper," but I don't want them saying you're just like Jack the Ripper. That's pretty wild times, isn't it?
So, Kenny, I mean, it's extraordinary success your little story has had in Australia. Is that right? It's the number one comedy in Australian history?
It's the highest grossing film, Australian film, in about 3 or 4 years, I think they said it was. And the DVD over there was outselling Superman 3-1, you know. So like, and yeah, the DVD is the number one selling Australian DVD ever since the inception of DVD. So, I mean, crazy, you know. I mean, let's face it, you know, if you'd have said to me 4 or 5 years ago that I'm going to be the subject matter, if you will, of a feature film, I'd have thought that makes about as much sense as, I don't know, a surgeon setting up a business at a cemetery. You know, it wouldn't make any sense at all. But, you know, you fast forward to the current day, and yes, it's a pretty amazing stuff.
And has it changed you, Kenny? You still seem like a normal bloke. You're still wearing the outfit there, I see.
Well, it's kind of, no average. I'd like to think I haven't changed. I mean, it's always amazed me that some people, when you press the record button on a tape recording device like you've got here, or even on a camera, that people become someone else. I don't quite understand how one little red button that says record can change an entire human's personality. I often find that the people that probably change, I guess, who they are when the cameras turn on, I probably weren't happy with who they were before the cameras were looking at them. Whereas I'm pretty happy, mate. I've got a pretty good life, I think, anyway. You know, I've got a job. I get to work outdoors. I get to work with a great bunch of people. I get to work at rock concerts and festivals and fates that other people pay to go to. I get paid to be there, you know. And I've got a job. It's a trade. I'm a plumber. And, mate, I've got a son who's healthy and happy. He's got, you know, two of all the things you need, two of them, one of everything you're supposed to have one of. And, you know, I'm stoked, mate. I couldn't be happier.
Well, you've got a very kind of helpful philosophy to getting through life there, Kenny. Is that a particularly Australian philosophy, would you say, or is it something you've kind of garnered from reading the books of Albert Camus, Jean-Paul Sartre?
I've got to tell you, I have trouble reading the speed limit on a road sign. That's all I take time to. Actually, I got scared here. You've got the Reading Festival, and I thought they said it was a reading festival, and I got nervous when I went there. I was going to have to read a book with 120,000 people. I thought that'd be a shocking festival. 120,000, or however many are there, are all sitting around reading books. I went to a reading festival. Surely you'd play a bit of music, but how wrong was I? But no, look.
We do have a literary festival, Hay on Wye, and I don't think their shit stinks there.
No, look, I can tell you, speaking from a little bit of experience, if anyone says it doesn't, liars, a lot of them, guarantee you, lies, all of them. No, look, my outlook on life, I don't know whether it's uniquely Australian. I will admit, one facet, you know, Australia isn't steeped in history necessarily. We don't have any of the amazing, or stunning, to be quite honest, buildings that you've got here and the history, you know. I mean, most of our ancestors knocked off a loaf of bread and that's how we got there, you know. But the one thing we do have is a bit of a survivor mentality. I think we've always been all right at that. And I guess you'd say it's what we call the she'll be right, you know, because it will be right. You know, she'll be right is our answer to most stuff. And, you know, the old expressions used to be when the going gets tough, you know, the tough get going. I used to say when the going gets tough, get stuffed, you know, just go and hide. But when I was a kid, I think, as you know, once you become a parent, I think you realise it's our job to kind of, you know, set a bit of an example. And I'm, I'm a manager at work and I've got to lead a team of blokes in a not so desirable job in other people's eyes, but I love it. So, I reckon you're supposed to lead from the front a bit, you know, and mate, you know, every day I get up, I open the newspaper, the only thing I do is I look in the obituaries. If I don't get a mention, I go to work.
Well, there's a moment in your film, Kenny, that that is very touching. You do some big business with the Japanese through a night out, through the own force of your personality. You have a nice night out with the Japanese, and you almost seal a million dollar deal for what must be the hugest consignment of shitters in the history of Australia.
Well, truth be told, I didn't nearly sign it. They actually did sign it. They ordered that, and the deal went. And I can tell you, I wasn't sent over as a sales rep. I was sent over just to do a bit of research, really, on if you have, for those that haven't seen the film, the film crew that followed me around, or the paparazzi, as we call them, they followed me to Nashville, Tennessee, to the mecca of waste management, as we call it, the International Pumper and Cleaner Expo. And when I was over there, I met a wonderful Japanese gentleman. And look, I said, I was sent over there by my boss just to have a look at the new goings-on in the world of sanitation, you know. Not that technology's come too far. We're all built the same way, you know. The hole's down the bottom end and gravity's a big help. But there's some stuff that evolves in the world of sanitation. Yeah, I met a wonderful Japanese guy, as we call him, the sushi cowboy. And, we had a great old time. And lo and behold, it resulted in a very lucrative deal for the company. And I can guarantee you, I'm not a sales rep. Have a look at me.
Now, let's talk about this bloke, Geek Clayton Jacobson.
Oh, yeah, the director bloke.
He's the director, right?
Yeah. Right. Lovely guy. Good bloke. In all honesty, you know, we're almost like brothers, the way we get along. You know, he's a kind-hearted bloke. And, look, we spent 2.5 years together, mate, with him filming me and coordinating all the camera crews and stuff. And I know him very well. I almost feel like I've known him forever. But he's a good man. He's got a good heart. And realistically, in Australia, they're raving about him for his ability to make a movie, you know, because he had to edit it all and do all the fancy stuff. So, no, he's a good man. It's just his brother that I'm not too keen on.
This guy, Shane Jacobson.
Yeah, he's got a brother, Shane Jacobson, or Casper, the ghost, as I used to call him. He's supposed to be the co-producer of the film. And every time I turn up on location, never there. Shane Jacobson. And he's an ugly man. If you've seen, he's got a face like a drop pie. Guy looks like a face like a fistful of mints. Face like a robber's dog. So, no, you don't want to meet him. He's no good.
Now that you've done all this, kind of, I guess, the AFIs, the Australian Film Institute, your huge success that you've had, Kenny, you're clearly a kind of star. Presumably you've been rubbing shoulders, those beautiful porcelain white shoulders with Cate Blanchett and Nicole Kidman.
Yeah, I've had an opportunity to meet all those lovely people, and they've been, it's overwhelming, there's no doubt about it, you know, because they're real stars, you know, they're real actresses and actors, you know, and sometimes I'm a little bit lost to words, which is a small miracle in itself. At one point there, I didn't know what to say for a good 1 to 2 seconds, you know, and that's a very big pause in my life. And so, look, I got to meet Nicole Kidman, and she's a wonderful woman, and same again, heart of gold, you know, couldn't wish to meet a nicer person. And Cate Blanchett, you know, Jeffrey Rush, yeah, heroes of mine, you know. And, you know, I could live to be 700 and I'll never meet people as nice as those. And so, no, it's been a bit overwhelming. But more importantly, it's a bit of a change for me because they're shaking my hand, you know. And I can guarantee you, in my life, when people find out that what I do is plumb toilets, no one's ever been in the rush to grab a hold of my hand, I can guarantee you.
You do seem very happy in that environment, Kenny. A pig in shit is a word that comes to mind. Not that you're a pig at all.
No. I've always thought that was a weird expression. Everyone goes, he's as happy as a pig in shit. I've always thought he'd say he's as happy as a pig in another pig. Now, that would be a very happy pig, I would imagine.
And finally, Kenny, you mentioned there that the Cate Blanchett and Nicole Kidman and the whole Australian Film Institute. Were you tempted there at the awards due to nip into the toilets, have a little look, see what the stars leave behind them?
Well, I already know what they leave behind. It's not like anyone's going to. I mean, there's been
Nicole Kidman's. It'd be little and lovely, wouldn't it?
Well, it's only in nursery rhymes where a bird can lay a golden egg, if you know what I'm saying. It's a nursery rhyme. It's not reality. And I know they're all the same, mate. I can guarantee. I've seen them all.
Kenny, great to see you. I would shake your hand, but frankly, I'm just not interested.
The world according to Kenny, or Shane Jacobson, or Kenny. I couldn't tell by the end. Staying with comedy now, I can recommend another surprise in Hot Rod, the latest Saturday Night Live spin-off to reach unsuspecting UK audiences. This time it's Andy Samberg, who stars as Rod Kimball, hopeless but determined suburban stuntman who believes his late father was Evel Knievel's sideman. Rod and his loser chums attempt various rubbish feats, all on Rod's useless moped, until they're inspired to attempt a jump of 15 buses in order to raise money for a heart operation for Rod's ailing, bullying stepfather, played by Ian McShane. This is occasionally hilarious, with several inspired touches of lunatic comedy, 80s power ballad montages and the usual nerdy idiocy. Like one of Hot Rod's pool jumps, it soars only briefly, however, and eventually comes to earth with a bit of a splat, but it did make me laugh, out loud and often. Mr. Woodcock is similar but slightly less funny. A starrier vehicle, it features Sean William Scott as a successful self-help author returning to his hometown, only to discover that his attractive mum, Susan Sarandon, is dating his former sadistic PE teacher, Mr. Woodcock, played by Billy Bob Thornton in a red tracksuit. The various plans to thwart Mr. Woodcock give rise to scenes of Oedipal embarrassment, which are sometimes amusing, but the comedy peters out as everyone resolves to forget the brutal past and play happy families. The week's British comedy is Mrs. Radcliffe's Revolution, featuring the major debut as a lead of TV comedian Catherine Tate. She's a Leeds housewife in the late 1960s, whose husband Frank, fired up with socialist zeal, gets a job teaching in East Germany and moves the whole family behind the Iron Curtain. Ian Glen gives his character Frank a depth and soulfulness quite absent from the rest of the film, and I met up with the actor who, after a period of big screen absence and starring in The Blue Room with Nicole Kidman on the London stage, at last seems to be getting the parts his talents deserve.
So let's talk about Mrs. Radcliffe's Revolution, because in that film we go back to a kind of lost time, and I think you embody it rather well, actually. Did you study loads of Open University professors or something?
A little bit. I mean, it was not uncommon for people to sort of have a passionate belief in the theory of communism. And the late 60s, Vietnam War made people sort of really question, you know, the West and America and kind of imperialism, and people embraced the idea, the theory of communism, as something that, you know, perhaps offered an alternative where, you know, there was a quality of opportunity. So although the character I play, the father of the family, Frank Radcliffe, in some ways an idealist, he was not so, you know, as extreme as hindsight might make us believe. You know, it was quite popular at the times for people to have a belief, and people really didn't know about the practice. They knew the theory, but not the practice.
Exactly. I thought it was rather sweet. You don't meet people there. You don't see people on screen very often like that, with that kind of zeal. It seems very sort of mid-60s.
Yeah, I know. And I loved it. It was great fun to play, you know, and he was passionately enthusiastic, you know, and hard to resist, you know, and certainly his family found him hard to resist because of his belief. Really.
Was that you as a student? Can I see the young Mr. Glenn kind of shouting in the streets?
Not really for political things. I think I was quite wildly enthusiastic, but not for politics at all.
Yeah, because I mean, you were a university student.
I was, yeah. Yes. I was at Aberdeen University, yes, but I wasn't a natural academic, I have to say.
Right, no, but in the 70s, I mean, it was, which I think that places you right, I mean, there was a time, there was the Students' Union was a big thing, Trade Union
that's
Congress
right.
was on telly
yeah,
that's a lot.
Right, absolutely. No, I remember the union. One of my friends, who is now sort of right-hand man to Richard Branson at Virgin, was head of the union at Willie Whitehorn, and I was very impressed with that. But absolutely, but politics was strong. It was in the air, and people, I think, were generally a little more active. I wasn't, but people were. We've become a bit sort of lazy now. Power seems beyond our control, and we let others get on with it. But at the time, people had real conviction and acted on it.
Yeah, that's what this film kind of meant to me. And it's funny seeing Mrs. Radcliffe so soon after something like The Lives of Others, which I'm sure the two weren't conceived at the same time.
No, they weren't. And they're very, you know, they're very different in tone. I adored The Lives of Others. I thought it was the most wonderful film and gave a real sort of insight into, you know, the actual workings of the Stasi and how they operated. And in some ways, there's a kind of, you know, there's an overlap with Mrs. Radcliffe's revolution, certainly the kind of territory, obviously the country that we're in. And it's about how people get suffocated by that kind of state control. And our film is very much about that, but ours, you know, is very comedic and in flavour. And, you know, I've seen it with audiences and it works, and it's so satisfying as an actor seeing a comedy work for an audience. Mm.
So, I mean, you got to work with Heike McCatch, who was an actress I've known when she used to live here, and she's got with Daniel Craig.
She did, yeah. Funnily enough, I've worked with her like two or three times. I don't know if that's coincidence, yeah. We did a film called Tara Road where we were married, I think, and I can't remember one other, which I've forgotten.
Right, well, yeah, you've got things on your mind, you've got a child. But you also got to work with Katharina Taubach, who was in Schlöndorff's The Tin Drum.
Yeah.
Fantastic German character actress, yeah. Hysterical in the film.
She is, she's brilliant. And, you know, as a sort of UK actor, going into, we were pretending it was the old GDR, she was from the old DGR, I was really sort of interested in how she would feel about it, whether we were sort of, you know, just Brits abroad taking the piss. Mm. And she really loved the script and felt that it was an angle on the subject that she hadn't, you know, witnessed before, or, you know, or certainly been a part of. So, that was very reassuring, having the German actors say how much they liked it. But she's a fantastic actress.
Because it's funny, I remember interviewing for this, for Film Weekly, Florian von Donnersmarck, who made The Lives of Others.
Right.
Not, I mean, I thought it was a terrific film, and then I met him, and he was a bit serious.
Was he?
Bloke. Yeah,
right.
didn't. And I said, well, you know, there are a lot of people who did believe in this kind of ideal.
Yes, yes.
And knowing about the existence of Mrs. Radcliffe, he was like, no, it was terrible, and it was awful, and yeah. There's all bad people. And I was like, well, I did think, you know, from Goodbye Lenin as well, another comedy set behind that scene, that there were a lot of people who did have that ideal that you were talking about.
No, I think that's right. Coincidentally, I worked with Ulrich Mauer, who tragically, you know, died recently from cancer, who was so wonderful in Lives of Others. And it was great, just from a work perspective, that he did that film.
What did you work with him?
I worked with him on a film called Spy Zorga, which was we did in Japan with a basically Japanese cast. The majority of the actors were Japanese, and there was just me and him really who were European. Yeah, lovely, lovely man. But seeing him on the screen, The Lives of Others, knowing that he was ill, and you know, he wasn't he stunning in the film.
I know, extraordinary to have that as your epitaph.
Yeah, it's you know, I know it's in the grand scheme, it doesn't really matter, the acting stuff, but lovely that he got to finish up with that.
Tell me about, obviously, working with Catherine Tate, because she plays your on-screen yes. wife there. I mean, not hugely experienced in feature films herself, and this was kind of, I guess, her biggest role in them today. How was she? Did you have to sort of help her through a bit?
Not at all, no, not at all. I mean, she comes from a theatrical background. She trained as an actress and went to drama school, I think. And her sort of her comedy routine and her TV show just became unbelievably popular. And so, of course, people just associate her with that now. But I think it's wise on her behalf that she's, you know, she's moved into film. And I think certainly at the time she was saying that she had finished with a TV series. Now, I don't know, I'm not sure if that's changed. Mm-hmm. And it is, for an actress, it's a different thing to do, to carry a role and carry the story of the film in the way she does. And I think she's fantastic in it, in the role. You know, there's a subtle filmic performance, and you know, I'm sure she's capable of whatever's asked of her.
So, are we going to see you in a Catherine Tate sketch show soon?
I don't know. I hope so. I hope so. It's like, you know, it's like, as you say of her, people, you know, people have impressions. People might have impressions of me, and I would love to do more comedy. And you know, it's more part of the reason that I was really drawn to Mrs. Radcliffe's, even if I am a little bit straight in it.
Yeah, because you, I mean, it is interesting what you do. I mean, I've seen you on stage in the Blue Room in Nicole Kidman. Mm-hmm. In fact, when I sort of boning up, like having a look at all your things, I said, God, he played opposite some corking actresses. I mean, Nicole Kidman, Angelina Jolie, that's right. Mila Jovovich, I suppose.
Yeah.
I mean, they're always kind of high. They're always the kind of they're kind of above the line there.
Absolutely,
you're always given these kind of like you have to kind of look after huge celebrity star actresses.
It's true, absolutely true. And yes, and I'm often slightly neglected, like in the Blue Room, where you know I stripped naked for 15 minutes during the course of the play, and no one batted an eyelid. We got completely hysterical about, Nicole being, facing upstage and stripping for about 0.5 of a second. So she was
theatrical Viagra.
That's right. What and I was just sort of, I don't know what I was.
Warm up act.
Ian Glenn there. Mrs. Radcliffe's Revolution is depressingly poor, but Ian's pretty good in it, and he's a jolly nice chap too. The big hitters this week are Jodie Foster and George Clooney, two actors who are always watchable no matter what material they appear in. Jodie's back on the mean streets of New York, recalling the 70s sleaze of Taxi Driver in Neil Jordan's perfectly stupid vigilante film, The Brave One. After a mugging in Central Park that leaves her fiancé dead, Jodie buys a gun and takes revenge on various clichéd scum, all the while hosting a radio show about the sounds of the city. A cop, the always excellent Terence Howard, is onto her, and the pair head for a moral showdown. Were it not for these two charismatic leads, this would be laughed out of town. The plot's ridiculous, the dialogue outdated, and the violent sentiments too muddled to even be controversial. In campaigning liberal mode again, George Clooney is Michael Clayton, a shady fixer for a corporate law firm. He looks handsome, true, but he also looks very bored in this too self-consciously 70s-style conspiracy film. There are shades of Erin Brockovich here as George realises that maybe he's working for the bad guys after all and bids to save the poor, exploited farming folk, but the film's so badly constructed and edited that I lost interest despite the furiously overacted efforts of classy British co-stars Tilda Swinton and Tom Wilkinson.
What if Arthur was onto something?
What do you mean, onto what?
You, North, what if he wasn't crazy? What if he was right?
Right about what? If we're on the wrong side?
Wrong side, wrong way, everything, all of it.
This is news. This case reeked from day one. 15 years in, I gotta tell you how we pay the rent.
But what would they do? What would they do if he went public?
What would they do? They're doing it. We don't straighten the settlement out in the next 24 hours. They're gonna withhold $9 million in fees. Then they're gonna pull out the video of Arthur doing his flash dance in Milwaukee. They're gonna sue us for legal malpractice. Except there won't be anything from the wind, because by then the merger with London will be dead. We'll be selling off the goddamn furniture.
The week's sly charmer and my recommendation is Rocket Science, the first feature film from director Jeffrey Blitz, who gave us this superb documentary Spellbound about the competitive world of the spelling bee competitions in US schools. For Rocket Science, Blitz switches to high school debating, focusing on the story of Hal Hefner, a young boy whose stammer won't even let him order the pizza he so craves in the school canteen. Despite his impediment, Hal's recruited by the bossy debating team head, Ginny Ryerson, and attempts to confront his demons through public speaking. However, he doesn't count on the ruthless ambitions of Ginny and the little heartbreaks of being a teenager. I asked the director, Jeffrey Blitz, just how personal his creation of Hal was.
I've never really been interested in normal teen movies. They tend to hew so closely to a certain kind of Hollywood formula. The outsider kid who wants to be cool and wants to date the cheerleader who happens to have, a bigger heart and a bigger brain than anyone would ever think. And, you don't think he's going to get the girl, but you know he will, and eventually he does. And that just describes so many Hollywood teenage movies out there. And they're just vapid, and
We kind of grew up with them, though, and I suppose that there was a point in our lives when we identified with them and kind of enjoyed them, but I guess as a director, you just don't need to make any more of them.
Yeah, but I also have to say that while I knew those movies were out there, and I'm sure that I went to see them, none of them had any staying power for me at all, like, I didn't ever crave seeing another movie like that. I was much more into sort of adventure movies and then into adult movies. And somehow that whole kind of teen fantasy genre never really appealed to me.
So let's, for example, say in The Breakfast Club, is there one of the any of those that you identified with?
You know, I was kind of hover somewhere between class clown and class brain. So I don't really think I fit into any of those neat groupings like that.
You know, I was like you. I never particularly loved the film or the music, actually, the whole thing. But I did love your, let's go back a bit, because I did love your wonderful documentary, Spellbound. I think everyone did. I remember watching that in a room full of, you know, critics who don't really, you know, get involved in the film too much. But because it was a kind of nerdy film and it was testing, and the critics were sitting there spelling stuff, I could see kind of aged men kind of going, oh, you know, PX. You know, they were really, really trying. And it had this kind of this narrative structure to it.
Yeah, no, thank you for that. Yeah, it's a funny sort of thing. I feel like in nonfiction form, you can have a movie that follows a kind of the flow of a sports movie if that's really how things go. Mm-hmm. Then, you know, the fact that it's real allows it to tap into some of the tropes of that kind of storytelling. But in a fiction film, I think you have to be much more careful about whether or not you let some of those things in or not, you know?
It was almost as that your documentary has a more kind of clear narrative than your actual fiction film does.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that in both cases, what I'm looking for is an approach to storytelling that feels like it's fresh. And in the documentary realm, to me, it felt like it's fresh to try to bring some of this sort of fiction film sense of unfolding drama into it. For the fiction film, I felt like it was fresh to try to bring sort of a more organic and naturalistic approach to how the story unfolds.
Mm. Well, I think what is exciting about Rocket Science is, as anyone who's seen Spellbound and knows it's the same director, the leap is quite obvious. I mean, you must be tired of answering questions even for yourself. It you know, it's clearly the work of the same guy, but they're two extremely different films. They're kind of, and obviously one, I don't even want to kind of ask you, but I'm going to have to. There's the person in there. You've always mentioned that you were kind of class clown and class super brain. There must have been the high school person in you that's been in for both spelling bees and high school debating.
Well, actually, I never participated in spelling bees at all. They were at the schools that I went to. I think spelling bees were considered too much of like an old-fashioned way of teaching. So I didn't actually ever witness a spelling bee until I was in graduate school and I caught a little bit of one on television. But public speaking was something that I did when I was in high school, and I really took to it. As someone who grew up stuttering, for me it felt like a special kind of achievement that I could get up and do public speaking, and that eventually I got very good at it. Although the first year of trying to do it, I was much like the character in Rocket Science, is that I was more tongue-tied than I was silver-tongued, to be sure.
So your stammer, what age did you overcome that? Because, I mean, it's a little explored genre on film. Certainly, it's been used, let's remember, Fish Called Wanda comically, and it drew quite a few complaints from those that suffer from it. And the only other film I can really think of it that's dealt with it sympathetically is a little Stephen Frears film called Liam, set here that Ian Hart played a father. And it rarely features on screen, and especially so sympathetically as it does here in your film, Rocket Science.
Yeah, thank you. Actually, just as a side note, when the film just screened in Scotland and someone with a stammer came up to me after the film was done to tell me how much he liked it, how much he appreciated that the portrait felt very real, but that it would have been a better film had there been two or three people who stammered in it, which I thought was great, you know.
I think, I mean, apart from your film being quite inspirational for anyone that does have a stutter or any whatever shorthand that is for anything that bothers them that they need to overcome, because I think, you know, we've all got one of those things. When did you actually overcome your stammer and how?
Yeah, well, let me say that I have not overcome it. I go through periods and times when I'm very fluent and then other times when I'm not at all. Right. So you're lucky that I'm quite fluent this afternoon. Otherwise, I'd still be answering your first question right now.
I met you at the Edinburgh Film Festival opening night party, and neither of us were particularly fluent, but I don't think that had anything to do with speech patterns.
Yeah, no, that's true. I have no comment beyond that, though.
Jeffrey Blitz, director of Rocket Science, a delicate, quirky indie comedy that's one of the sweetest films of the year, with one of the oddest soundtracks, too. Also out this week, Across the Universe, a quite dreadful musical from Julie Taymor, trying to tell the story of late 60s hippie revolutionism through 33 Beatles songs, resulting in characters called Jude, Lucy, and Prudence, and dialogue like, "Hey, she came in through the bathroom window," and a scene in the radical student headquarters beginning with, "You say you want a revolution?" I mean, for sheer indulgent pomposity and patronising tweeness, it's one of the worst films of this or any other year. Easily the best music and dancing of the week can be found in the documentary Gypsy Caravan, When the Road Bends, a sort of Buena Vista social club for the Romani people, as gypsies from four continents assemble in New York for a concert of insane fiddling, lots of clapping, and deep, deep drags on cigarettes. Johnny Depp gives heartfelt support, but while the gig looks vibrant enough, the film's forays back into the Romani heartlands to trace the performers' backgrounds and families are rambling and unilluminating. Finally, Belgian director Lucas Bellevaux, he of that extraordinary trilogy of a few years back, returns with an enjoyably original curio, the world's first social realist caper movie. The Right of the Weakest follows unemployed steelworkers in Liège, cajoled into committing a robbery, mainly to buy one of their number a moped and to restore their male self-esteem in an increasingly automated world. It's The Full Monty meets Germinal and Dog Day Afternoon, and I rather enjoyed it. There's also a remake of the original Halloween by Rob Zombie and a film called War with Jason Statham and Jet Li together at last, but they wouldn't show those films to the critics, so we'll just assume they're rubbish or that, quite possibly rightly, there's nothing any critic can add to them that will put more bums on already overcrowded seats. So, that's it for this week. I've been Jason Solomons. Film Weekly was produced by Paul Noble, and until next week, happy viewing.